This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says it's holding expert-level meetings to review Washington's response to Tehran's amendments to the EU proposal for the revival of the JCPOA. British teachers and charities warn that widespread hunger will be the biggest challenge facing schools in England as children get ready to return to classrooms. And Colombia's new ambassador arrives in the Venezuelan capital as the two countries restore full diplomatic relations following a three-year break. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. And with our top story this hour, Iran says it has under expert review the U.S.'s latest positions on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says it will offer its verdict once meetings reach a conclusion. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says no timetable can be set for Iran's feedback. He reiterated Iran's seriousness in the talks to revive the JCPOA, adding that Tehran has so far acted responsibly. Earlier this week, Washington gave its response to Iran's amendments to an EU proposal. The EU has called Iran's stance reasonable. The deal was thrown into chaos when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Since last year, Iran and the remaining signatories have held multiple rounds of talks to revive the accord, with the U.S. indirectly involved. Iran has been demanding a strong, durable deal that guarantees its interests. In the UK, as children get ready to return to classrooms, teachers and charities warn that widespread hunger will be, quote, the single biggest challenge facing schools. The challenge has led to calls for the government to introduce universal free school meals. Charities are angry that the threshold for free school meals has not changed since 2018, despite soaring inflation. According to a charity group, 800,000 children living in poverty in England miss out on free school meals, despite cost of living struggles of families. That number is expected to rise. Schools are also facing other challenges as well. The president of the National Association of Head Teachers says some schools may have problems to keep the lights on. The new revelation comes amid reports that inflation in the UK is already at a 40-year high of more than 10%. Cabin crew members of a low-cost Spanish airline have started a 10-day strike for higher wages. 8 Iberia Express flights were canceled on Sunday alone.
We want a decent salary revision. Our salaries have been frozen since 2015. Here we are only a small part because people are still flying due to a very high minimum service. So we are here. We are only a small voice of a large collective.
A total of 92 flights are expected to be grounded, affecting more than 17,000 passengers. Iberia Express said in a statement it had arranged alternative flights or transport for 84% of affected passengers. The rest asked for a refund or vouchers. The walkout was called by the Spanish trade union USO in protest at stalled contract negotiations. Inflation in Spain hit 10.8% in July, prompting unions to call for a salary increase. In recent months, several European countries have experienced strikes over pay, working conditions, and soaring cost of living. Gas and electricity prices have risen to historic highs in Italy, with businesses complaining energy bills have gone up 10 times compared to last year. As Max Civili reports from Rome, thousands of Italian businesses risk going bankrupt in the coming months.
Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls, with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
EU foreign policy chief says a proposed visa ban for all Russians planning to travel to the bloc is unlikely to be unanimously backed by member states. Joseph Borrell made the remarks as EU foreign ministers are expected to discuss the issue later this week. Borrell said he is not in favor of stopping delivering visas to all Russians. He added that cutting EU's relationship with Russian civilians would not be helpful. Some EU members have demanded collective action to stop all Russians from traveling to the EU on tourist visas by freezing the 2007 visa facilitation agreement with Moscow. The ban is intended to be a punishment for Russia for the war on Ukraine. Earlier this month, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged Western countries to impose a blanket travel ban on Russians. Kremlin says any attempt to isolate Russia or Russians has no prospect of success. Venezuela and Colombia have restored full diplomatic relations, which were cut off for 3 years. A new Colombian ambassador is now in the Venezuelan capital. Armando Benedetti said relations between the two South American countries should never have been severed, as they are brothers. Earlier, Colombia and Venezuela had appointed envoys to each other's capitals as part of their plan to reboot relations. Bogota and Caracas have also agreed to fully reopen the border between the two countries. Colombia's newly elected leftist president, Gustavo Petro, had promised to improve ties with its neighbors. Under the former right-wing Colombian president, the two countries' relations had turned sour. The lawyer of a Palestinian inmate who's been on hunger strike for around 6 months says he is now in a terribly difficult health condition. 40-year-old Khalil Abouabda, the father of four children, has been refusing food for 169 days in protest at his detention without charge by Israel. His lawyer says he is suffering from serious weight loss and has difficulty speaking due to his prolonged hunger strike. Abouabda was supposed to be released by Israel last month. However, the regime reneged on its promise to put an end to his so-called administrative detention. Abouabda has been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism and has been placed under administrative detention 3 times ever since. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel with no charge or trial. They are denied access to basic rights such as medical care and are frequently subjected to systematic torture. A Palestinian rights group has condemned Israel over the death of a 6-year-old patient in Gaza who was denied access to medical care in Al-Quds for months. The Gaza-based rights group Al-Mezan says the 6-year-old died on Wednesday after he waited for Israeli authorities for nearly 8 months to approve his exit permits. The rights group says delaying access to necessary medical care for a toddler for so many months is another grave rights violation by the regime. The group called on the international community to take measures to end Israel's blockade on the Gaza Strip and its violations of international law. Almazan says at least four patients, including three children, have died following Israel's rejection of requests for exit permits or the regime's delay in issuing those permits this year. The UN Security Council has in the past years convened many times to discuss whether or not to give Palestine full membership. And now Palestinians are saying they want a vote again. The move, however, comes amid U.S. objections to Palestine becoming a full member of the world body.
The Palestinian Authority has renewed its push for full membership at the United Nations amid long-time acts of obstructionism and opposition by the United States. Any application for full membership at the UN would need approval from the Security Council, and that means the U.S. participation. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN says he has been consulting with Security Council members over a possible full membership bid over the past weeks. But the U.S., a full-fledged supporter of the occupying Israeli regime and a UNSC member with a veto power, on the other hand, has once again reiterated its opposition to the move, saying it will block it. The U.S.'s reason behind rejection of the Palestinians' push for membership: it should only occur after the resolution of an agreement for a two-state solution. But the real reason behind the U.S.'s opposition to Palestine's move is that membership would mean full international recognition of Palestine as an independent country on the international stage. In other words, Palestinian statehood, and that would be consequential for Israel. Yet the U.S. is at much fault for Palestinian situation, as is Israel. PA's ambassador to the UN has said, given that the peace process has been frozen for 8 years and that there is no initiative on the table, the issue of full UN membership should move forward.
Well, the United States provides $3.8 billion of military aid to the Israeli occupation every year on an annual basis. So what this means is that the United States is a full partner in all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Israeli regime. And this has been the case for decades upon decades. I mean, throughout the nearly 75 years of Nakba against the Palestinian people, the United States and other imperialist powers like Britain and France and Germany have been full partners with the occupation and these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, Palestinians have the right not only to full representation and recognition at the United Nations, but more importantly and fundamentally for the liberation of all of Palestine. And, you know, really what we need to be talking about is kicking Israel, kicking the Zionist regime out of the United Nations, not just recognizing Palestine.
In 2012, Palestine was granted non-member status, but this was done in the General Assembly, where no member has veto power. And now this has raised the assumption that Palestine may be following the same path to gain full membership. The Palestinian Authority's push comes just several weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, where world leaders are set to convene in New York for their annual summit.
138 UN member states and two non-member states recognize Palestine as a state. Palestine has also been a non-member observer state of the UN General Assembly. Among the G20 countries, nine recognize Palestine and others have conditioned their recognition to negotiations with Israel. This is where the U.S. role comes to the fore. Past experience shows the U.S. has not acted successfully in its role as a mediator.
Israel says any vote for the Palestinian cause and against its illegal actions impedes negotiations and progress in a chance for better lives for Israelis and Palestinians. The regime claims that a vote against it would obstruct peace, but these claims come in contrast to what is happening on the ground. Just looking at the past few weeks, Israel has ramped up its attacks on Palestinian towns and cities, leaving dozens dead and many others injured. Palestine, on the other hand, has been adamant that its full membership was essential if there was to be any chance of leading a dormant peace process. But why is Israel so persistent against Palestine gaining full UN membership?
Well, what we've been seeing throughout the years is that in the United Nations, the United States has consistently used its veto power in the Security Council in order to prevent the Israeli regime from being held accountable for its crimes, just as it has used that same power in the Security Council to attempt to impose its will upon other countries and to protect its own war crimes and crimes against humanity from being held up to any meaningful form of accountability. And so, of course, the Israeli occupation wants to completely erase Palestinian identity and existence, and that's been the case for the past 75 years. But what's really important is actually to fight back against and boycott and isolate, including in the United Nations, the occupation regime. Because simply saying that, Palestine is recognized in the United Nations is not doing enough to actually liberate Palestinians from the grasp of colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014. Among the major sticking points in those negotiations was Israel's continued settlement expansion activities in the occupied lands. Iran's proposal for the issue of Palestine told a mass referendum, something Iran's leader has said would be a logical solution to the conflict.
Moving on, Pakistan is appealing for international aid as it struggles to cope with the aftermath of devastating flash floods. Pakistan's foreign minister described the flooding as overwhelming, saying the country's overall economic situation would be affected. Bilawal Bhutto Zardari urged financial institutions, including the International Monetary Fund, to take the economic fallout into account. Unusually heavy monsoon rains have caused devastating floods in both the north and south of the country. The downpours have affected over 30 million people and killed more than 1,000 since June. Pakistan was facing an economic crisis even before the natural disaster struck, wiping out crops, providing much of the country's livelihoods. Bhutto Zardari says the IMF board is expected to approve the release of $1.2 billion next week as part of Pakistan's bailout program.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. New polling shows that a majority of California voters do not want Joe Biden to run for office again in 2024, with equal percentages of Democrats saying that progressive Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and their state's governor, Gavin Newsom, would be their top choice to replace the current president. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Bernie Sanders, Gavin Newsom Tied to Replace Joe Biden in 2024. New polling shows that a majority of California voters do not want Joe Biden to run for office again in 2024, with equal percentages of Democrats saying that progressive Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and their state's governor, Gavin Newsom, would be their top choice to replace the current president. Joe Biden has seen his approval rating tank rapidly over the past year, leading some Democrats to raise alarms that he would be unlikely to win a second White House term in 2024. Many have also raised concerns about Joe Biden's age, as he will turn 82 shortly after the next presidential election. While Biden's age and health may be a concern to some, a sizable portion of California voters don't seem bothered by the prospect of Bernie Sanders, who will turn 83 in 2024, becoming president. The independent senator from Vermont, who successfully sought the Democratic Party's nomination in 2016 and again in 2020, tied with Gavin Newsom as the top choice for California's Democratic voters. According to new polling published on Friday by the University of California at Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies. Bernie Sanders, who won the 2020 Democratic primary in California, and Gavin Newsom, a 54-year-old, both were selected as the top choice to replace Joe Biden as the 2024 nominee by 13% of Democratic survey respondents. Vice President Kamala Harris, 57, who previously served as a senator for California, came in third, with 10% selecting her as their top choice to replace Biden. Gavin Newsom pulls ahead in the survey when respondents' second choices are factored in with their first options. Then the California governor is backed by 25% compared to 18% who supported Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris. Overall, the opinion poll showed that 61% of California voters of all political persuasions oppose Biden seeking a second term in office. Among Democrats, 46% oppose the president running for the White House again, while an equal percentage support him seeking another 4 years as commander-in-chief. The survey was conducted from 9th to 15th of August among 9,254 registered California voters. It had an overall margin of error of plus or minus 2 percentage points, while the sampling error among Democrats being plus or minus 2.5 percentage points. The Washington Post first reported in April that Bernie Sanders has not ruled out making a third bid for the White House if Joe Biden declines to seek re-election. The news was based off a memo from a top Sanders advisor, Faze Shaker, who was the former presidential candidate's 2020 campaign manager. The memo was distributed to progressive allies, advising them on how to embrace attacks about the senator's support for their candidates in the November midterm elections. Analysts have posited that Gavin Newsom is weighing a potential 2024 run, even possibly in a direct challenge to Joe Biden. The speculation mounted in July when the California governor released an advertisement in Florida slamming the southern state's governor Ron DeSantis. While former President Donald Trump is seen as the potential frontrunner for the GOP presidential nomination in 2024, Ron DeSantis is regularly floated as the strongest alternative. A previous July poll by News Nation and Decision Desk HQ showed that nationally, Kamala Harris would be the top choice for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination if Joe Biden does not run in 2024. The current vice president was backed by about 16% of respondents, while Bernie Sanders came in second with almost 11%, and Gavin Newsom came in third with about 9%. The survey included 1,000 registered voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. President Biden and other White House officials have repeatedly said that he plans to seek re-election in 2024. The president has asserted that Donald Trump running for office again would make him even more eager to seek a second White House term.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Atar, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on behalf of me, Mr. Mahmoud, the producer of the program Viewpoints, and all the staff of Call of Islam Radio. With me in the studio, our two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
We're welcome to the show, and Sheikh Muhammad Khan, assalamu alaykum wa
rahmatullah. Walaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the proper and standard ways and methods of doing the morning processions and the rituals done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the month of Muharram based on the speeches and thoughts of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, we can say the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. First, let's get to the definition of morning procession or azadari. In Arabic, we say as al-azal Husayni. In English, we can roughly translate it as the morning processions or the ceremonies. Sayyid, in Urdu, say what? Muharram ki azadari, huh?
Yeah.
They would say that, right. Okay, so what is it exactly? How do you define azadari?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about azadari or mourning, obviously it has an apparent meaning and it has a technical meaning.
Okay.
There are two different things. So we need to differentiate between both. Generally, what we perceive in the public or when you talk about this, they're talking about its apparent meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Its apparent, we can say, like definition of mourning, and that is to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And obviously, there are many narrations that we have seen. But obviously, there is a message in it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a technical meaning. There is a definition which has been given by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
Okay.
And why actually this azadari or this mourning is so important? Because, you know, we have a narration from Imam Radha alayhi salam as well. He said to Ibn al-Shabib, Ibn al-Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you want to cry upon anything,
or shed tears.
Shed tears, yes. You must shed tears on Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. What does it mean? You know, for example, if I have a loss in my business, and I want to shed tear or I want to cry.
Okay.
Rather than crying on the loss that I have, it's better to cry on Imam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
There is a reason behind it. There is a logic behind it. There is a goal, you know, and that is a higher goal than what
yes.
we just perceive in general days. So when we talk about the azadari or the mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam or Azza al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, it's basically to mourn of for what happened for Imam Hussein, that's the first thing,
mm-hmm.
that's the apparent thing.
Okay.
But behind this, You know, because by shedding tears, our hearts become softened. Mm-hmm. You know, shedding tears makes hearts soft.
Okay.
And it makes grounds to, you know, to basically absorb the actual teachings of Islam. Mm-hmm. The reason for which Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam stood against Yazid, that was to revive and reform the Ummah and revive the actual Islam, which is Muhammadan Islam.
Yes.
So by shedding tears on Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, by attending all these, you know, sessions that are being conducted in the month of Muharram and Safar, the 2 months, it is because so that I can get closer to the actual deen, to actual religion, which is the Muhammadan Islam. Mm-hmm. And through this, obviously, the journey which I can have, obviously, it becomes closer. Okay. It becomes faster.
That's right.
So when we talk about the majalis, obviously, we are talking about the actual Islam, mm-hmm. not just crying on the grief or the incident that has happened.
The tragedy
is
not
that
the actual. Place.
Yeah.
That's right.
But generally, people look at its apparent meaning, and then they think like we just need to mourn means mm-hmm. to cry for Imam Hussein.
The shura, the passionate. Yeah. We can say is more powerful than the intellectual one, but it has the as it is clear, it is a procession. Okay, mm-hmm. The morning procession, it has a beginning and an end. How should we start it? I mean, where to start it? Can we, for example, give it a specific picture that has been done during the history?
I think if you look at human beings and we take. We take it from the viewpoint of a human being and look at it from that aspect, mm-hmm. makes it much more beautiful. Like the traditional way of conducting these rituals or having these processions and these programs, when you compare it to a human being and the needs of a human being, you see that it fulfills some of the most essential needs of a human being. So I don't think that we should change it necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite good that we actually have a lecture mm-hmm. which benefits the knowledge and
That's
the intellectual
right.
part okay. of a human being. As human beings, we need to be satisfied intellectually. But at the same time, we need to be satisfied emotionally as well.
Okay.
As Said, he referred to or pointed towards that it reforms our hearts when we actually...
It prepares the ground.
It facilitates the opportunity
okay.
that we reform ourselves and we become open to the Islamic teachings when it softens our hearts, when we stir up the emotions in our hearts. So, as he mentioned, he reformed the society. We should start by reforming ourselves, mm-hmm. make ourselves, create that capacity so we have the capacity to be receivable to the teachings of Islam or the teachings of the message of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam from Ashura.
Okay.
So we afterwards, on the second phase, can make sure to implement it in our social mm-hmm. life as well.
That's right.
So I think actually if you look at how we are doing the different programs, I believe it's very good. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like in some cultures, you recite Ziyara Ashura first.
Yes.
And then you stir up some emotions. Then you appeal to the intellect of a human
yes.
being. And then afterwards, you have some eulogy, you have some poetry
okay.
that stir up the emotion mm-hmm. again. I think it's a good mixture.
Okay. The sermons, we have a sheikh or a sayyid on the member
exactly,
giving the speeches, sermons.
Exactly. So I think the lecture, the mixture of a lecture mm-hmm. and eulogy and poetry
yes.
and all that, it's very beautiful because
okay.
it actually takes human beings and our needs into consideration mm-hmm. when we're planning it or organizing a program like that. In other words, all the different needs that we have as human beings are being met.
That's right.
The intellectual, the emotional.
Okay.
And it creates that emotional bond because in social learning or social learning, where you talk about the behavior of human beings,
yes.
one of the most important parts is that the people that we have an emotional bond to, we learn from them socially.
Mm-hmm.
Like we look at how they conduct themselves, their behavior, the way that they used to practice different principles, and we try to attain that. In other words, we see them as role models, mm-hmm. therefore, because of the emotional bond that have been created. So if that emotional bond is created to Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, the Shuhada of Karbala, it becomes beautiful. That's one
right.
of the ways. It actually paves the way for perfection for that
mm-hmm.
person, because he creates that emotional bond to those individuals. And if he finds out how they used to conduct themselves, which he does
That's
through
right.
the speeches
okay.
and the lectures,
yes.
then it's a complete package.
And usually in the month of Muharram, you could see that how passion is everywhere about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in the mosque, in the majalis, even the houses. You know, some people have made their very small houses into a majlis for the rawza of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
And even if they're not emotional about it, they're disciplined about it.
Okay.
Right? Yes. And that discipline is very important as well.
That's right.
Because Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, sometimes the emotions accept something, sometimes it doesn't. It turns away, your heart turns away from something, right? Emotions, they come and go. But the fact that people are disciplined enough, some people, they cry in the majlis. One day, the first day, the second, the third day, they cry for Abdul Ali Salam. The fourth day, they don't feel like crying. They can't shed a tear. But they're disciplined enough to show up. Right.
For and example, at least 10 days be present in the majalis of Imam al-Hussein.
And that discipline, the concept and the perspective, that discipline, we need that when it comes to practicing the religion. A person without discipline, religion will be something which is a source of irritation for that person. It will be a source of discomfort for that person. Where a person who understands or lives his life according to the principle of being disciplined in his worldly affairs, he will find religion as the best program and most compatible with, than any other ideology that exists out there, right? So it would find its place like completely naturally. So I think the fact that they're disciplined about it is very important as well.
That's right.
We just need to maintain that discipline outside of Muharram and Safar as well, right?
Inshallah. But during the month of Muharram, especially the 10 days of the morning processions and the rituals, you could see that the bazaars, I mean, the markets are closed. For example, the people are in the streets wearing black colors or putting a flag, a black flag, you know, on the entrance of the houses. And these, we can't say, morning processions are done in groups. People are coming, especially going to the holy places like a holy shrine or Imam Sadas or the holy Muslims are doing that. And these morning rituals are there. We cannot delete it from the Shiite legacy for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Isn't it true, Sayyid?
Yeah, that's true. Obviously, in the Quran, we have a verse, وَمَنْ يُعَذِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ. Whoever respects the slogans and the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, indeed, in this respect, there is a, you know, taqwa of the hearts. And for surely, because Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam and Ahlul Bayt are from the Sha'air Allah, they're from the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The way Mecca and Safa and Marwa is the from the Sha'air Allah. The way the Zamzam or Kaaba is the Sha'air Allah. This is why, because, you know, Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam has reformed the nation. Imam Hussain has revived the true Islam. Therefore, he became the Sha'ir Allah. We have in the ziyarats as well, Ya Thar Allah wa Ibn Tharihi, oh, the blood of Allah and the son of blood of Allah. Now, there are many things like, you know, the questions that people would ask, like, does Allah has a body or a blood or something like that? For example, for Imam Ali alayhi salam, we say Yadullah. It's the hadith of the Prophet. He called him as Yadullah, the hand of Allah. Wajhullah, I don't know, Aynullah, Asadullah, all these things. For the Kaaba, it's the house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, for this, we need to understand what does it mean, basically. This is tasharruf. It's an honor which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, you know, this happens in East. I don't know about the West, whether they have this culture or not. But in the East, we have this. For example, if you know, we have a boy in our
neighborhood
who respects the others, who respects the elders. And if I like him, and one day if he comes to me and he says, oh, uncle, can you get some place for me, like for work or job or something like that, I will take him to one of my friends and I will say, like, this is my son. You know, he's my neighbor's son, but I'm referring him to as my son. Why? Because his respect in my eyes, because of the respect that he does to the elders and the way he's good. So he's so good that I'm placing him as my son.
That's right.
And I'm increasing his level of, you know, the respect or the status as to be from my, you know, because if I go to my boss or anyone and I say, like, he's from my neighborhood, and he needs a job, that has another effect. If I say, like, this is my son, or like my son,
that's right,
I like him just like my son. So that increases his level of, you know, nobility,
respect, that's right,
respect, and all those. Similarly, those things that has the most respect in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah has referred them as something to himself, like wajhullah, aynullah, my eye, my hand, my face, my home. For Imam Hussein, it is said, Ya Thar Allah, the blood of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm-hmm. The blood that was shed in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the land of Karbala, Allah, the Aima alayhi salatu has said, like, this is the blood of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wabna Tharahi. Wabna Thar Allah.
Yes.
Because the blood of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was also in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this blood, it costs, it's so precious that it becomes the blood of Allah. Mm-hmm. It's not the actual blood, but it's related to. So it shows the closeness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So similarly, because Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, or the struggle that he had, this was for the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, in the Quran, Allah has said, وَمَنْ يُعَذِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ.
That's right.
So this respect that we have, mm-hmm. these 10 days when we close our, you know, the markets, the people are mourning.
Yes.
They are remembering Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Okay. This remembrance is actually remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Nawi. For it was very kind of proper understanding of the morning rituals done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the month of Muharram. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us in another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa mamati mamata Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were guilt-thirsty, oh Hussein.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's wait-and-see stance on Israeli regime's escalated attacks against several prominent Palestinian organizations puts their staff at risk of arbitrary detention and torture. Those groups and observers warn. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. gives green light to Israeli regime's attacks on human rights groups. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's wait-and-see stance on the Zionist regime's escalated attacks against several prominent Palestinian organizations puts their staff at risk of arbitrary detention and torture, those groups and observers warn. The Zionist regime raided seven organizations in Ramallah area of occupied West Bank last week, shortly after an Israeli regime military commander rejected an appeal lodged by some of the organizations challenging an order designating them as terrorist groups late last year. Tel Aviv claims that the organizations are front groups for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party with an armed resistance wing that is outlawed by the fake regime of Israel, the United States regime, and the EU. All seven organizations, including Al-Damir Al-Haq, the Bisson Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International Palestine, the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Health Work Committees, were sealed shut and issued orders declaring their groups unlawful. The Zionist regime troops confiscated equipment and, in the case of some of the groups, files from the raided and sealed offices. Defense for Children International Palestine and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees say the Israeli regime troops seized files containing sensitive information regarding child clients and women receiving psychological support. The targeted groups have been working in Palestine for decades and receive international funding to support their work. That work includes providing legal representation to Palestinians held without charge or trial by the Zionist regime, international human rights advocacy, providing jobs and social services to Palestinian women and farmers, providing health care to rural communities, promoting women's and workers' rights, and representing children who are tried in the Zionist regime military courts. Put more simply, the organizations are either dedicated to challenging Israeli regime impunity or strengthening Palestinian steadfastness and resiliency under the extreme pressures of perpetual military dictatorship. Because they are a point of friction for the occupation, they have been subjected to harassment and smear campaigns by the Zionist regime and its proxies for years, including raids and the arrest and detention of their staff, in a bid to hamper their work and dry up their international funding. Khaled Qusmar, the director of Defense for Children International Palestine, said during a webinar hosted by Democracy for the Arab World Now, a U.S.-based organization founded by the murdered writer Jamal Khashoggi recently, "In the past, they used to work in order to silence us, and now they're working in order to eliminate us, eliminate our work, and even the organization." Qusmar was summoned by the Shin Bet, the Zionist regime's secret police, for an interview recently following the raids. The officer made clear that he knew detailed information about Qusmar's family members in order to intimidate him. "They haven't faced ever any real accountability," Shaban Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, said of the Zionist regime during the same webinar. "They failed in the last 15 years to silence us, to push us back, to get us down and dry our resources," he said, leaving the Zionist regime with the final tactic to declare them as terrorist organization. "They are not ready to accept this. They challenge them to prove what they say." Like Qusmar, someone claiming to be an agent with the Shin Bet The Zionist regime's secret police called Jabarin recently and summoned him to a nearby military base. Jabarin, who said that phone call was of a threatening nature, refused to comply. He added, "If they have a problem with Shawan Jabarin, the only thing I ask for is due process and a fair trial. Let them take me today," he said, pledging to continue his organization's human rights work despite the personal threats. "If there is one person who should be behind bars," Jabarin said, "it's Mr. Gantz and his commanders, those who are responsible for committing war crimes in the occupied territory, including Gaza, East Al-Quds, and the West Bank." Jabarin was referring to Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime's war minister, who issued the terror designations against Al-Haq and other groups. Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime's war minister, is a person of interest in the International Criminal Court's investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza, which was opened last year. The United States and the Israeli regime, as well as many of Tel Aviv's European allies, some of whom fund the organizations targeted by Gantz, opposed the ICC's investigation in Palestine. Three of the targeted groups, including Al-Haq Ad-Damir and Defense for Children International Palestine, have provided evidence for the ICC investigation. During his visit to Al-Quds last month, Joe Biden pledged to shield the Zionist regime from accountability, including at the UN and International Criminal Court. Earlier this week, The Guardian reported that a classified CIA report shows the agency was unable to find any evidence to support the Zionist regime's decision to designate the Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations. The U.S. agency received intelligence from the Israeli regime regarding the designations, but like multiple European countries, did not find any evidence to support the claim, The Guardian reported, citing two sources familiar with the study. Despite not buying the Zionist regime's claims, Washington has so far refused to publicly challenge the Israeli regime over designations and other measures taken against the Palestinian groups. The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said this week that we continue to seek additional information from our Israeli partners. He added that we remain concerned about the impacts of the closure of the offices of these Palestinian NGOs in and around Ramallah, and we've made clear to our Israeli and to our Palestinian counterparts that independent civil society organizations in the West Bank must be able to continue their important work, he said. But when asked why the U.S. wouldn't forthrightly condemn the Israeli regime's actions, Price said, "The Israelis have told us that they have information in their possession that would justify taking action against the groups." Price was admitting that the United States is giving the Israeli regime indefinite time to retroactively justify the designations, potentially putting the organization's staff and wider networks at risk of arbitrary detention and torture. "I found the most troubling element of the U.S. response to what happened last week to be the statement about waiting for more evidence," Laura Friedman of the Foundation for Middle East Peace said during the Dawn webinar, adding, "Because waiting for more evidence is not a passive statement, it is an active green light and encouragement for Israel to crack down further on these groups in order to try to manufacture more circumstantial evidence." Friedman pointed to the discredited secret dossier on the groups that was given by the Zionist regime to European diplomats in May 2021 and supposedly contained information that justified the terror organizations. Friedman said that dossier consisted virtually entirely of evidence in the form of statements made by Palestinians under interrogation after they had been arrested by Israelis for similar charges. This is coercive interrogation on top of an already coercive military court system that leaves Palestinians with no due process. In another recent event, Friedman noted that the Zionist regime operates a plea bargain factory in its military courts. Joanna Rishmavi, a Spanish aid worker in her 60s, took a plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the health work committees, which was declared illegal by the fake regime of Israel in early 2020. The health work committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against it, arresting its director, Sata Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Friedman told the Dawn webinar, "What Rishmavi pled guilty to effectively was unknowingly providing aid to an organization that Israel defines as a terrorist group." The Zionist regime held up Rishmavi's plea agreement made in a highly coercive context in which Rishmavi had no hope of actual justice as proof against the targeted organizations. 24 independent UN experts condemned the Zionist regime's escalating attacks on the Palestinian groups and urged the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, which includes the U.S., to protect the Palestinian organizations and staff whose offices were raided and closed. The experts also called on the EU and its member states in particular to use their leverage to stop these aggressive attacks. So far, European diplomats have only managed to muster up photo ops and toothless statements of concern, even though the European Union is implicated in the designations. Even Zionist groups such as Americans for Peace Now, J Street, and the New Israel Fund are urging Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, to address Israel's persecution of Palestinian civil society, challenging the complicity of the U.S. regime, which subsidizes the Zionist regime's military occupation and provides Tel Aviv with missiles used to bomb residential towers in Gaza, and shields the Zionist regime from accountability through its veto at the U.N. Security Council, remains key. It would only take one phone call from Secretary Blinken, Al-Haq's Susan Power said, adding, "Just one phone call."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.